3:35, today, Wednesday, February the 7th. We have with us Senator Stevens, Senator Green, Senator Wilkowski, and myself, Charlie Huggins. On the agenda today is the Alaska Natural Gas Port Authority, or Development Authority, excuse me, in parens, Alaska Gas Marketing System, as I recall. Right. Is it market or marketing?
Mark.
Market.
Market.
Okay. And the memorandum of understanding between ANGDA and ANGPA. And in that sense, Senator McGuire has joined us, and we have in the room, in addition, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. Who else we got? Good. Today is our first presenter, and probably our primary, and there may be some others that have some comments will be Mr. Harold Hines. He probably needs a little introduction. But before I do that, if you are with ANGDA, would you raise your hand or someplace out there so we can recognize you? You're here by yourself?
There's only two of us in the whole world.
Okay.
And,
all right, good.
And Corey was operated on yesterday.
And if you're with the ANGPA, as in Port Authority, would you please just demonstrate? Okay, we got Paul and Bert Cottle with us, and more to follow on that. So if you would, Harold, put yourself on the record and let's hear from you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Harold Hines. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska. My title is Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. We commonly refer to it as ANGDA. Basically, ANGDA is a creation of the people in the 2002 election through the initiative process. It was created with the purpose of doing everything we could as a public corporation to help bring North Slope gas to market and to do it in a way that offered Alaskans the maximum benefit. Since then, we've worked on a number of things. We've kind of had our ups and downs, looked down different ways. We have twice issued statewide reports to the people, and so forth. My purpose here today is to cover with you very briefly an outline of a proposal that we have sort of put on the table with our board of directors. Previously, I have sent a copy of it to you. I don't intend to go through the whole booklet, the narrative, and whatever. I do intend to just sort of highlight some of the high points of it. This whole Alaska gas market system, and it's an acronym that can't be pronounced, so we just say AGMS. And we don't try to pronounce it because it would twist your tongue very badly. AGMS is a proposal that we've put together in response to a couple things. Number one, on December 5th, we were one of the dozen organizations that met with Governor Palin on her first day and second day in. In the course of that conversation, she reminded us of what ANGDA's purpose was. And she asked what we were doing to fulfill that basic charter we had been given by the people of Alaska, and how we were working to assure certain things were happening. We took that message to heart. And we went back and we kind of reflected on what we had done and not done for the last 3 years. And what you see in front of you today is a response to that. I will tell you that when we presented it to our board, they were very enthusiastic about it. It is something that they embraced. As just sort of part of the prelude of getting into this, I want to say to you very much up front that we are trying to be responsive to AGEA, the proposal to come out of the governor's office at some point on legislation related to the whole gas line issue. I don't have any real knowledge of what that proposal looks like or that legislation will look like, but I have listened carefully to the speeches. I think I have a reasonable understanding of the principles that the governor has espoused, and I will tell you that what we are putting on the table seems very consistent with that. And obviously, once a proposal is put on the table, we will adjust or do whatever we've got to do to participate in that process. We think we have something to contribute to the process, but we don't see ourselves as a favorite son or anything else like that. We see ourselves as one of several people working simultaneously to address the needs and the challenge, frankly, of the AGEA by the governor. Again, before maybe I even get too far into the project, let me tell you a couple of the virtues, and maybe that's a good place to start here, is to describe to you the virtues. First of all, what we've put forward as a proposal is a starting point. It is not intended as an end point. It's a place to start a dialogue. It is intended to draw in participants, and by that, the very broadest range of people we think may be interested in doing something with North Slope Gas and making something happen out into the future. We ask that they join in the effort in a study process which does not require them to make any commitments to forego any other activity they wish to take. The only commitment involved is that they participate through in-kind expertise, and they recognize that this will be a transparent and public result that comes out of it. We think there are a number of people that have things to gain by their individual entree that way. They may choose to participate with other people. They may choose to go forward themselves as individual companies and entities. But the framework we're proposing, I think, fits them. So it is in that spirit that this was developed. It is intended to be cooperative and non-exclusive and inclusive of people. The proposal itself, as you'll see, addresses a couple, three issues that we think will probably be involved in the gas line initiatives, not only of the past, but out into the future. One of them is that the proposal that was on the table clearly provided for a pipeline transiting Canada. And while we have nothing against the Canadians, we do not think badly of them in any way, shape, or form, it is also very clear to anybody reading the industry news that the Mackenzie Delta pipeline is in trouble. And that situation has deteriorated significantly in the last 6 months, and in particular in the last 2 months, we're seeing some judicial challenges there that could place a lot of it in jeopardy through no fault of, quote, the Canadian government or their intent or anything. It's just the process may break down or bog down. Secondly, one of the realities of everything that's been on the table and we've talked about in the state related to the gas issue is that it required the approval and the agreement of all three producers in a unanimous sort of way. And it may be that as the process proceeds, that becomes difficult, and that may result in delay and other issues. It will, at that point, be, I think, the responsibility of the individual companies to address what they want to do in that regard. That is their choice. Each of the companies has a responsibility individually to market their gas. Each of them has individual responsibilities to their shareholders to make decisions and to move forward with development if they consider it to be a good opportunity. And while there is certain interactions that have to take place with them, it's clear at this point that at a state level, you in the last session addressed some issues that were very important to them. It may be that there is a need for greater flexibility into the future. Our proposal addresses both of those issues, overcomes both of those challenges, in that there is no Canadian leg to it. There is no requirement that all three producers agree. It is a very doable project on a much smaller scale. The other virtue that I have to sing up front is that it is designed around Alaska. It meets Alaska's energy needs, and it does it in a timely fashion. And with that, and let me sort of jump to, you have somewhere in your packet a little map, and it might be easiest if you just looked at that, and I will just sort of try to describe to you how we got there and what it's all about.
Yeah, Carl, before you do that, just let the record show that Senator Wagner and Senator Stedman have joined us. And I might add that the Herald is asked or will allow us to ask questions whenever, and I think it's smarter as long as we don't start delaying the process too much. So if you have questions as we go, please ask them.
Sure. Thank you. I managed to finish my prelude without any questions, so I'm wide open now. If you look at this chart of the Alaska gas market system, the concept here is a pipeline that splits in Glen Allen and goes to both the Cook Inlet and Valdez areas. The starting point when we actually derived this was to start in Cook Inlet, because Cook Inlet, Fairbanks, the Yukon River represent the Alaska gas needs of our citizens, not our industrial needs, but our citizen needs. And if you look at that need here in Alaska, it's something like 200, 250 million cubic feet a day. On the scale that you're used to talking to, 0.25, one quarter billion cubic feet a day. So it is a number that's far less than 4.5, 5, or 6 billion cubic feet a day that many people talk about. But that's the entirety of the Alaska need on a citizen level for energy. That's gas, that's electricity, that's propane, that's everything we can think of to meet the energy needs of Alaskans. And as I'll describe to you in some other parts of this, we think there are ways that that energy and that sharing of energy can take place throughout the whole state so that everybody does have a stake in it. But the key part is to recognize that's the number that, from an ANGDA perspective, is the target. That is the number that we want to make sure is taken care of. It's a good number. It's an interesting number to put in perspective for you, because if the state chose to take its 1/8 share of the known reserves at Prudhoe Bay, which would amount to 1/8 of 24 trillion cubic feet, that would be 3 trillion cubic feet if you do the arithmetic. And if you divide that by 1/4 of a billion cubic feet a day, that works out to about a 30-year supply. So Alaska has the ability to meet its needs for a generation. And that's the target here of what this is all about. Unfortunately, 1/4 billion cubic feet a day is not a lot when you're looking at the distances, the investments, the issues, the challenges that are involved here. It represents a small fraction of the total reserve, but it is costly to come from the North Slope of Alaska all the way to Tidewater, all the way to the Cook Inlet area, down through Fairbanks, and so on. And as such, what we looked at was that cost when spread over that small market looked to us to be a difficult decision. I'm not going to tell you it can't be done. On the other hand, it is a challenged decision. It would not be a very comfortable thing to be out there betting Alaska on doing that project. So we looked at how do we make this project work, and in particular, how do we take some of the burden off of the Alaska consumers, the individual consumers. How do we take some of the cost burden off of them and still meet their energy needs? And that's when we introduced the leg in here that goes 110 miles south from Glen Allen and delivers 1 billion cubic feet a day to Valdez for the manufacture of LNG and the transport of that LNG across the waves to destinations known and unknown to different people. The idea here,
Earl, if I could,
sure.
Because I've been asked this, I'll ask you at this point in time. Some have asked why you wouldn't just use a larger pipe and do the what you're fixing to describe in Valdez and just in Cook Inlet and run the export market out of there with just one line.
Okay, there, Mr. Chairman, there's two questions sort of inherent in what you've asked there, and let me see if I can just sort of separate them here. The one question is, why the numbers, why the volume you picked. And this is intended as a minimalist project. The feedback we've gotten from people as we've kind of formulated this and discussed it is nobody has suggested smaller numbers. They have always suggested bigger numbers. But again, we think that's the way you start this kind of a process, is with a minimal type approach. The second thing is, why Valdez as opposed to Cook Inlet? And there are several ingredients that are important in Cook Inlet. Number one, you have right now both a fertilizer manufacturing plant and an LNG manufacturing plant there. Both of those, if they were involved in this project, would help pay the bill to get the gas into the Cook Inlet area. And I've argued many times that the presence of those industrial customers would help us, not only with the project, but they would help pay the bill. So they're very important. On the other hand, very frankly, as to the two existing facilities that I've mentioned, when we've talked to them about their interest in being part of a project to bring gas to Cook Inlet, We have not received anything that I would consider an affirmative response. And so in deciding or designing what's on the table here, we stuck to what we were very confident of, which was the utilities, the electric and the gas. If at some point in this process, for instance, one of those industrial users came forward and said they would like to be part of this project, we'd be happy to do that. And actually, in the longer form of all this, in the narrative here, I included some tables where I did the calculations at 250 million cubic feet a day and 500 million cubic feet a day to Cook Inlet to acknowledge that that might develop at some point. But that's not the place where we start. It is a place where we could be driven towards. The other part is the inherent comparison of Cook Inlet and Valdez for LNG. We have an existing facility in Cook Inlet that was built there because that's where the gas was. The plant was built to take that gas that we knew about to market. It is a plant that has been operating for a long period of time. There is intrinsic value to it. It operates in a marine environment that is much more challenged than Valdez. There's a limit on how big a ships can be brought in because of water depth. Any of us who have been up and around there are days when it is difficult to navigate in Cook Inlet because of the ice. It can be done, but it is difficult, and so on. Valdez, when you talk to people that are in the LNG business or the energy marine transport business, they will tell you it's a great port because it's deep. And again, while we tend to think of it as a little narrow, it is a wide open port, it is big, and more importantly, if they were involved in building the LNG facility, and if they were involved in providing the tanker delivery to the marketplace, they would like to do it in a place where they could use any of their tanker fleet, even the very biggest of the big ships, even yet to be built. And the reason for Valdez, very frankly, at this point is the potential participants we're looking at would pick it over Cook Inlet as it stands right now. But that's not to say that something couldn't be done vis-a-vis the ConocoPhillips Marathon LNG plant there. There is a whole study we put out of a variety of uses of that plant, ranging from bulldozing to import to brownfield expansions of it, and so on. There's a lot of potential there, and it is could be a very important part of transition. But in the long term, this project does not rely on it being in the game.
I understand. Thank you. Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
If I could just follow up a little bit on that question of shipping to Cook Inlet. I guess question number one is, where when this says Cook Inlet here, where does that deposit it? Does that deposit it in the Wasilla area, number one? And then is there a pipeline system in place that would get that down to Kenai? I guess that would be question number two. And I believe we already have an LNG processing plant in Nikiski, which
yes,
would save us several billion dollars. So I'm just a little bit curious. Question number three is, what does the export market look like to Asia and kind of the going west?
Let me see if I can, through the chair, try and answer a few of those. And if I forget something, I'm sorry. I didn't write them down. I wasn't fast enough. Number one, the target we've picked in this proposal is to bring a pipeline into the Cook Inlet area and terminate it basically at the Beluga gas field. Beluga gas field was a huge gas field. It is largely depleted. It still has some gas left in it, obviously, but it had a lot that's been produced. It also is the co-location of the Beluga power plant, which is one of the main electrical generating power plants in the whole area. The virtue of bringing the pipeline to that area is that it allows you to operate the pipeline in a very levelized sort of way. Gas use in Cook Inlet is very seasonal. It varies incredibly between a cold day in the winter and a warm day in the summer, and operating pipelines that way is impossible. So this way we could run the gas to Beluga. What we don't use, we would put back into the ground and basically over a period of time recharge the reservoir as a storage. And again, there might be people that are very interested in owning the stored gas or doing other transactions, because it would be very efficient in terms of the pipeline transportation cost. As far as getting down further on the Kenai, There is a pipeline system in place that involves NSTAR, which is a commercial delivery system, and as such, we're visualizing a tie-in to that. But again, that might be a very up-down situation day-to-day and whatever. But they, you know, there are ways to make it work in terms of them drawing off whatever they need, where they need it, and still run the residual into the Beluga field and that. The third question related to, or that second question related to getting to the Kenai, there are pipelines that cross from the north side of Cook Inlet to the south where the Kenai LNG plant is. They are not necessarily available at this time for that kind of a service. So you could look at either some sort of conversion, adapting of those lines, or you could look at laying a whole new line to go on down there. And then third, very sensitive to the fact that there is a Kenai LNG plant. It does exist. It was basically placed in operation in 1969. It's a very high-quality plant. It, by modern standards, is extremely small. But that's because it was built 35 years ago, and that was the technology of the time. The current technology for such a plant would be 6-7 times bigger, to give you a feel. The plant itself represents, in terms of a dock and storage facilities, certainly a facility you might be able to use. It is not, I don't think it could be placed in the same category as the type of facility we're describing here. The LNG plant that's described here, 1 billion cubic feet a day, is 7 million tons per annum. And the Kenai LNG plant runs at about 1 million tons per annum in round numbers. So it's a whole different scale of operation and mode of operation at this point.
Okay. Good. Senator Stedman.
Yes, a few minutes ago you mentioned the 8th share of gas, you know, as a supply, and could you maybe elaborate on that, how you perceive that relationship maybe with the current owners or of the gas or new supplies and or just removing the state's 8th and leaving the producer with his 7/8 on the ground?
The next page, I address both cost and tariffs and reserves and financing. And let me just skip right to the reserve issue because I think it's one of the crucial parts of what we designed here. This design is based on 1.25 billion cubic feet a day. If you do that for 20 years, that's 10 trillion cubic feet of gas. Right now at Prudhoe Bay, the estimated reserves, probably very accurately, are 24 trillion cubic feet of gas. So this project represents about 40% of the known developed Prudhoe Bay Reserve. People variously count other reserves on up to, counting Point Thompson especially, they get up to about 35. The big project that we've discussed many times is premised on 50 trillion cubic feet of gas, twice the known developed reserves. So again, this project is based upon a very modest reserve number. There's several ways you can get to 10 trillion cubic feet. Probably the easiest way to understand the arithmetic is the state has a 1/8 share of 3. You would need another 7. Each of the producers at Prudhoe Bay would have roughly 7 as their number, their share of Prudhoe Bay. So basically, the state share and one producer share would equal enough to provide the foundation for this project. Second way you can get there is, obviously, if you had two producers and they dedicated half, or you can do that arithmetic. The second way you can get there broadly is if you had the state's 3 trillion cubic feet and you had Point Thompson at the entirety of it, say, being somewhere from 6 to 9 trillion cubic feet, you've got enough to do this scale of a project. Those are two ways. The other third effect that's not real clear is that as soon as some project really starts to move forward, it's our belief that a number of explorers who hold acreage, who have defined prospects, for instance, on the north side of the Brook Range, will almost immediately drill. And if they were to find something, then that also becomes of great interest in moving forward a project of this size and scale, because you could obviously very easily adapt the project to be a little bigger, maybe to accommodate them, maybe to do other things. That basically is how we see it. The only other part of it I guess I should really make clear on that is we visualize that at the LNG end, that people who are in the LNG business would actually build, own, and operate that plant, that this system only would get the gas to Valdez, and from there on, others would basically take the responsibility in terms of firm commitments financially to move the gas. That having been said that way, what that means is somebody would have to sign with them some sort of a sales contract. And it would not be an unusual contract, but it would be a sales contract, and that would then allow them to have the contractual equivalent of owning the reserves in the ground. That would probably be very acceptable to some of the bigger LNG companies, whether it be BG Group, Mitsubishi, Sempra, as a basis for them to make very large financial commitments, because they have the markets, they have the other vessels to move it, and so on. It's their business. And again, at this scale, all the feedback we've gotten is that that is a very plausible thing. And again, it certainly is our intent in the study process moving this forward that those participants would be very key to understanding the LNG part of this. And how they see it will determine whether you do that or not, frankly. Did I answer most of your questions, sir?
Most of them.
Okay. I wanted to just talk a minute about sort of who we visualize being involved in this joint study process. And again, we suspect that there are a number of people that would be more than willing to contribute sort of in-kind expertise in a joint study effort that moved forward from a conceptual phase to enough information that people could start to make a decision on their own interest in participating in it. If you will, the start of a fairly simple open season process. I've listed them out here for you, oil and gas companies, including the producers, pipeline companies. We've had a number of pipeline companies that have expressed interest here in Alaska before. There are several other that are doing major pipelines in the lower 48 that might be interested under the right circumstances up here. LNG plant owner type potential people, LNG shippers. I put on the list experienced energy project investors. And the reason is that there is a lot of interest by a lot of big money in this kind of an energy project. And the reason is that it's done in America, sanctity of contract, secure. We don't take half of it while you're asleep one night and not even say thank you the next morning when we've confiscated it. And as such, there are people that would be very interested. They can be very valuable in helping you formulate the project because they can tell you a lot about basically debt service, all those kind of things. And ultimately, that is one of the key factors in coming to grips with what the tariff is how do you finance the project? And it makes a difference of almost a factor of two in the cost. If at the low end you assume a very simple utility-type financing, the pledge of the customer is the pledge, 100% debt, you get a very low annual requirement for revenue, maybe 10% of the capital cost. If you take a more aggressive regular energy project view, you might get as high as twice that number. And so there's a swing there that is considerable. The type of people that you would visualize here would be of help in helping you sort out what segments of the project might fit into which of those kind of categories. Certainly.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'd like at one point for you to go back and discuss a little bit about the propane that you mentioned for use in coastal river highway communities. Where that would happen, are we talking about Valdez, talking about Cook Inlet? What kind of a plant does it take? Is that a complex project? Procedure, is it complex or fairly simple?
Through the chair, Senator, if I could, let me just finish my list here, and it's right there in the markets, which is the next thing. I want to flag that we're interested in participation by the Alaska utilities, whether they be gas or electric. They have things to contribute. They may wish to be part of this kind of a project. The only way for them to make those decisions is to have good information. And the way you get the information is to participate in this kind of a process. I also listed the state of Alaska and the U.S. government. And the reason is that the state of Alaska and the U.S. government possess lots of expertise and information that is good and valuable in doing these type of things. For instance, the utilization of CO2 for enhanced oil recovery is a highly specialized area that may become of some importance in terms of the gas conditioning on the North Slope. It is an area where the United States Department of Energy is expert, and you would want them at least in the dialogue with you about something related to that. To pick up the propane part, which is first market in our mind is the utilities, gas and electric. The second market is the propane. One of the handouts is entitled Talking Points, and if you look at the back of it, there's a map with a bunch of yellow lines spreading all around Alaska. And the portrayal there is of our concept of how you handle the propane. Number one, you'll notice there's a bunch of yellow lines on the highway system. And again, you may not have a colored version, but trust me, there are highways on there, and you can obviously truck propane up and down the highway from a variety of spots. Again, whether it be Fairbanks or Delta or Glen Allen or Wasilla or wherever, you would have a fairly large number of wholesale propane facilities that people could basically develop an entrepreneurial business of trucking propane from there. I have a cabin in the northern part of the valley, and Matsu Valley, and we have three people that actually compete to deliver propane to us, and it's a good feeling, and it's a good product. Secondly, if you get the propane to Tidewater, and again here we are talking about very large numbers of propane. The gas on the North Slope is the opposite of Cook Inlet. The North Slope gas is very rich in ethane, propane, and butane, the NGLs. The propane in this case far exceeds what we can visualize using in Alaska. So you have an ability, once you get it to Tidewater, to move it via marine barge or in cargo containers, basically, shaped like your intermodal container that is received every summer by every village and town in Alaska. And you just slip in a container in there that actually is a propane tank. Maybe you slip in two or three if it's a bigger community. And you take the empties back with you and you bring them back next year filled, and it's just like a trade-in thing on your barbecue grill propane tank if you go down the hardware store. The third area of the propane, and the more difficult one from our point of view, is the Yukon-Kuskokwim River system. There's 100 communities on that river system, lots of thousands of souls in those communities. They are in probably the most difficult energy situation of anyone in Alaska. They are at the end of an extremely long and costly supply chain. They basically have very limited options for purchasing their energy. They are in kind of a tough spot. Yet, as a pipeline would come south from Prudhoe Bay, as it crosses that river, they potentially have the cheapest energy supply right there at the river of anybody in the country because they're so close to Prudhoe Bay. And if you extracted the propane at that point, then the problem becomes one of distributing it up and down the river system. And while we have some experience on the river system, there isn't a lot of information on the cost and the methods of distributing that propane on the river. So one of the things we've proposed, not here but separately in some other discussions, is what we've called a demonstration project for the logistics of moving propane on the Yukon-Kuskokwim River system. And the idea of the demonstration project is to gather information. We would do that by trucking propane to start with from the North Slope to the river. Very modest volume, but enough to give people a feel for what the issues are, let them practice, let us gather data, and other things like that. We believe that kind of a project can probably be sponsored very heavily by the native corporations. We believe it is a project that the Denali Commission might find very interesting in terms of their energy-type sponsorships. And Senator, that's about all I can tell you about propane now, but we have other write-ups, we have other things, and we see it as a way to reach out to a large group of people in different ways. The study we did of marine transporter propane indicated that every community in Alaska probably could be helped in terms of energy supplies, energy costs, by propane delivered to their community. In some communities, it was a big help, and frankly, in some communities, it was a small help. And again, it would not happen instantly. It might take a generation, actually, for it all to develop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to sidetrack you on this, Mr. Hines, but I guess my question is, and I apologize for my ignorance of propane taking it out of the natural gas. Is this what kind of a plant does it require? Is it a simple process? Are we talking about a major industrial plant on Cook Inlet to do this, or fairly easy?
Senator, through the chair, at each of the compressor stations, they will be drawing off some of the gas from the pipeline to use for fuel. One of the first things they will do with that is condition the gas as fuel, which means they will just cool it, and in the cooling process, the propane will actually drop out. Okay, so every place there's a compressor station along the pipeline, there will be a small-scale propane facility. The process involved is very simple. It just basically, the gas is at high pressure. You reduce the pressure on it by going through a special kind of valve. It cools the gas just like your refrigerator, and the propane drops out. You take the gas that is not propane, put it back in the pipeline, and send it on its merry way. This is a process that is done throughout the oil and gas fields. It is extremely common from small scale to very large scale. It is something we can get a handle around pretty easily. They are fairly low-tech facilities. In this case, our challenge is going to be much more how to work the issues of storage and distribution rather than separation of the propane.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Wagner.
Harold, if you would, just for the record, so people understand that are watching this at home, what is the difference in the BTU value of propane versus natural gas?
Natural gas is, we'll call it methane. The simplest, the hydrocarbon molecules, it has one carbon, four hydrogens around it. You go to the next one, it's ethane, and that has two carbons. You go to the next one, it's propane, and it has three carbons and four for butane. Basically, a molecule of propane has 2.7 times the energy content of a methane molecule. So you move molecules in a pipeline, you don't move BTUs. The more propane that's in there, the more energy you're actually moving down the pipeline, because some of the molecules have more energy content, more fuel content to them. That's why they're very good. The other part of propane, in the case we've talked about it here, is that it is a liquid. It is very dense at very moderate pressures and temperatures. And so it doesn't require super chilling. It doesn't require very high pressures. That's why it exists on your back porch, in your barbecue, and you never even think about it. It's that kind of an energy thing. There are other things that are more volatile, that are harder to handle in the sense of making them a liquid. There are other things that have higher energy densities, and you call them gasoline and other things like that. So it's an intermediate product. It has some real advantages. The important thing, again, is it's produced with the gas. It is part of the gas. But more importantly, in this high-pressure gas line, it can be transported along with the other molecules. Again, just maybe a couple other points, and then we can kind of go to wherever you want. The project we've described here is a very simple project. It involves pipelines. It involves a facility on the North Slope to condition the gas to go into the pipeline. It involves LNG facilities. If you look at just the pipeline portion of this, we believe that kind of a project could be done in 6 years. And the reason is that's allowing 3 years for construction, that this is a very simple design. This is 24-inch pipe. It can be made by any steel mill in the world. It is readily available. The equipment used to do this is readily available. The skills required to do this are readily available. For instance, different about this pipe than, say, a much bigger pipe is you can use welding machines on this. So you send people to school to run the welding machines. You don't have to hand weld everything, every joint on this type of a pipeline. All those things taken together say that we could be probably more timely than anybody has talked about for much bigger projects, and that is simply because of the simplicity. Inherent in the project is an ability to start delivering gas at an earlier point than other people might think of. We can actually ship gas from Prudhoe Bay without the big fancy conditioning plant being online. We can actually ship gas to Cook Inlet without the LNG facility being online in Valdez. As long as we know they're coming, if they're a year or two behind, you can make the whole system work. And the reason is that Prudhoe Bay gas is so rich that even with a 12% CO2 content, it still will burn great in your stove and it will burn great in the turbines. And if that's what we're doing with it, it makes sense to go ahead and get online as soon as you can. Not only from an investor point of view, but frankly from an Alaska energy need point of view, so that you got this sort of firm, large supply hooked up as soon as possible. There's probably other ways that I could describe that we've tried to simplify the project. One of the visualizations here is a maximum use of the taps right away that exists, for instance. For a pipeline this size and with this construction issues, it may be very wise over a large part of the route to stick right close to that taps right of way, either at the edge of it or just adjacent to the edge of it or something like that. It's good from a regulatory point of view. It's good from a construction point of view because you know a lot about that right of way. You've been looking at it for 35 years. You know every low spot in it, you might say, and you know what has to be done. Let me just describe to you the joint study process because, again, it's our feeling that while the project here is important, the study process may be actually the more important thing at this point. And I should emphasize to you that we're not looking for support of the project at this point. Ultimately, that will flow out of the people who want to build it, who want to be the participants in it. What we are looking for is support of the idea of moving forward with a number of people in a sort of voluntary sort of way, no commitments, no exclusivity, other than that they will work and contribute towards the project definition, understanding the project, defining it on an in-kind basis. We've proposed here that the state put up the $5 million of cash to fund what we think are the studies. We suspect that the in-kind effort that this could attract is probably valued at in the range of $5 to $10 million if you could even go out and buy the kind of expertise from these companies we'd be looking for. At the end of the joint study process, each of the participants would have enough knowledge that they could make an informed decision whether to go forward and whether they were to foot the bill for the next level, which might be more in the range of, say, $50 million as opposed to five. The advantage of doing this is that, as visualized in the governor's incentive approach that's been outlined, it encourages a number of participants to take a hard look, to come forward, and if they have some ideas, if they have some proposals, if they want to be part of something, it encourages them to do that without taking a lot of risk. On the other hand, it turns very quickly back on them in a year or more that they have to then make a decision whether to carry forward or not. And we think that's an appropriate time frame to look at this. I included here some of the details of some of the ways we would see this working. We would attempt basically to be the facilitator of getting this started. We see certain participants probably being willing to put some people working on this almost full time. And that's what it would take to kind of make it happen. A lot of other people would be part-time. The reality is that the process would be very public, very transparent, and everybody could sort of see what was going on, at least on this project. And again, just to maybe try to put this in perspective for you, why I come to you and I ask for that kind of support. As ANGA looks at the situation around us right now, there certainly are a couple obvious proposals that will be put forward in response to whatever the governor lays out as legislation. It seems to us that there are other proposals that are needed, and in particular proposals that focus on the Alaska market, because that is an important ingredient from the state's point of view regardless. Secondly, it's hard to know at this moment all the circumstances we may face a year from now and how you may feel a year from now. As you reconvene January next, there may be major delays facing you. This is probably the cheapest insurance you've ever dreamed of buying against that major dilemma, not just for you, but for all of us. To have something that we can at least look at and know it has the highest chance of being doable, it overcomes a couple of the largest delay challenges there are. And it's from that context that I put this forward with you today. We suspect that as the capital appropriation process would move forward, we'll hear a lot more about this. I suspect as you come to consideration of the governor's proposal that there will be issues on your mind then, and I will listen carefully to your instructions and make sure I incorporate all that into whatever proposal draft we have at that moment.
Yeah, if I might, Harold, a good presentation.
Thank you.
Taking what you just told us, assuming the route as you described it, knowing what you know and you anticipate from the governor, last year what we faced was everything we see doesn't say we're going to build a pipeline. There's no certainty. There's no contract start date. give me a 30-second burst on how your course of action might have more certainty to it potentially.
This isn't a negotiation. This is people working together that are potentially interested participants. It's working together in a circumstance where everybody has a lot to gain and nothing to lose. Again, because there is no exclusivity to it, there may be companies that choose to participate in this study very actively and also undertake their own proposals under whatever the governor puts in front of you. So at worst, all we've done is encourage more action and anticipation on it. Secondly, I think the result of the joint study is going to be to see that this is not the kind of a project where you need one person or one group of people, but where you need a number of people involved. And this provides then at least a framework to start to identify those people, for them to start to work with each other and understand each other a little better, and again, develop some of that background. Also, because it's highly visible in a public sense, who's there, what's happening, I think it aids whatever other discussions have to take place with whatever other parties under anything else. Our intention is to proceed simultaneously with whatever other efforts there are. We have no intention to interfere with or in any way create problems for the other issues. On the other hand, very frankly, if the moment comes where the state decides that it is faced with significant delay on some other alternative, then it may want to look hard at this and see if it is appropriate to move ahead. Having said that, I will assure you we have analyzed and we've discussed a little bit in the proposal here the sort of what-ifs. What if you do this project and then other things happen? And none of them seem, in our mind, to work out bad. They're all possibilities that seem very manageable and, frankly, probably good from the state's point of view. So we think that's kind of our take of how you how we contribute to the process moving forward on it.
Okay, let me make sure for myself and everyone else. Your system essentially can be viewed in two major categories. One, that it's complementary to a larger system that you take gas off of, and that given that there isn't that larger system, you could have an autonomous system. Is that accurate?
The system we've proposed is a minimal autonomous system.
Right.
Obviously, you could take elements of that, and if people were interested in changing the configuration, they could, and that would be part of the process that moved forward. For instance, in the past, an Enbridge has described a 36-inch pipeline. There might be very compatible with some of the ideas that are presented in here, and I wouldn't preclude it or include it at this point, but it's something that you could fit within this kind of a framework and come to understand. We also have looked at the fact that if this system existed, then it puts the whole context of what next you want to do in a very different light than as we sit here today. And it is not a negative sense that we have with that. It's a positive sense. It opens up alternatives. If nothing else, doing a smaller system to start with encourages exploration on the North Slope. And that may lead to some good things which then drive other things to happen. And again, remember that our basic concern here is that if there are delays that occur because of circumstances beyond the state's control, how long are you prepared to wait? And again, my read of the citizenry of Alaska is expressed through ANGDA, and our very creation is that there is an inherent frustration level of not physically doing something.
Thank you. Senator McGuire and Senator Wagner.
Yeah, to the chair, thank you, Harold. I always love your presentations. I think in a perfect world, everything you've said would be true, and I wish it was true, and I want it to be true. But I want to know, the dilemma that we face as lawmakers that we keep coming back to over and over again is that we need a gas supply. And there are three major producers in the state that own that gas supply. And so we talk about alternatives, we talk about what we can do and so forth, but we just keep coming back to this fundamental point, which is that we've got to have a willingness on the part of the people that own the gas to participate. And so I recognize, I think in your program, that you're counting on the voluntary, good-hearted efforts of those who should want to be a part of solving Alaska's energy dilemma here, but I'm just not sure that that's true. So I'd like to know from you, what would be the incentive on the part of the three majors to voluntarily participate in this when they may have, in their view, a competing proposal that would lead to, frankly, their goal of raising revenues for their shareholders? And I don't take a position on that one way or the other, it's just a fact. So what would be their incentive, and then how would you protect, and it's just a question, maybe you can't talk about it here, the proprietary information that may be brought to the table? We deal with this in Penn, where we do this exercise on homeland security, and we ask people to come forward voluntarily to solve these major dilemmas about if you have a power failure, and Fred's in the room, he knows this, how will you respond as a utility company, and so forth. And it's very difficult to get people to come in because they recognize that there's a risk, that they're giving up proprietary information. So what are the proprietary information protections, and why would the three majors be willing to participate?
Probably ought to deal through the chair, Senator. Thank you for the compliment, by the way, on the presentation. Let me deal with the second question first, maybe. And the visualization here is sort of twofold. One, companies tend to share things with each other when it is in their common interest. And there will be things here that maybe people like keeping close to their chest, and they might not like to have made public, but they are willing to share it with other people because it might lead to a better thing. And the other people maybe already know it, and lots of other reasons like that. The second mechanism that kind of helps there is part of the reason for the state to be involved is to help guide studies that would generate certain information in the public realm without them having to disclose that information. In other words, for instance, we might hire a contractor who might review their work and incorporate their work in a summary way without ever revealing to us the background of it in full detail. And that's a very common vehicle, and it is an issue of trade-off here. But again, we're taking our marching orders from the idea of transparency and that. It's not so that we're going to blab every secret ever known. As a matter of fact, later on, we're going to talk about the Port Authority memorandum, and one of the reasons for doing that is so that I can keep a secret. And that's the reality of it. We do with that all the time. As far as the gas situation and the three producers, Senator, you're a lawyer. I'm not. But my background suggests to me that, or at least I remember that, the decision to market gas is a separate decision of each of the three leaseholders in this case. The three key players in the Prudhoe Bay unit each have to make separate decisions on marketing. And to do otherwise, number one, strikes to the heart of their responsibilities to the state, strikes to the heart of the responsibilities to their shareholders, and if done wrong, also could represent prima facie antitrust violation. So there is a balance there that they have to find in thinking it through from their individual perspectives. I can't tell you at this moment that at some point, let's say over the next year, that these people who fiercely compete with each other in many other settings won't decide that somebody else is causing them delay in accomplishing something that is important to their company. And they might choose to make an independent decision. And you can visualize that scenario however you want. I'm not suggesting it will happen, but it could. And again, I'll just observe to you, in the last session, it was very clear to those of us who weren't in Juneau that the three producers, in very close cooperation, worked with you as a legislature, and a major piece of legislation was passed. As we look forward to what may happen in this session, it's less hard for me to see where they have that same strong common interest. And it may be that some of the companies have thought about other things. As far as their interest in this project or not, last time I looked, companies don't pass up the opportunity to understand whether there are better ideas out there, other projects. If they were involved in this, that represents absolutely nothing other than a general interest. They're not committed. They're not doing anything other than participating. Also, there are other producers who have comparable knowledges and experiences and other things that might choose to participate. I would hope an Anadarko would look at this very seriously. I can't tell you that Shell might not express some interest. Other people like that. That of course, as soon as one or two of them speak up, it's very hard for the others to not speak up, because how do you let them know something you don't know? And it gets very Machiavellian all of a sudden. I am being somewhat idealistic, but the reality is that if things move forward easily and quickly and in unanimity amongst the producers, so be it. That's great. I'm all for it. And we haven't done anything to threaten that, harm it, or whatever. We may have even encouraged it a little bit in some minor way. But on the other side of it, if that doesn't happen, My interest is in the state of Alaska, and I don't like where we sit at that moment. And this is a way to at least give us something else to work with. And again, if somebody else comes up with something better else to work with, I'm all for it, and I'll get out of the way.
Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, Mr. Hines. First, you're a reservoir engineer, so you'll like this one. You talk about balancing the system out on gas and storing the gas in Beluga or some similar field. Do you lose a percentage of the gas when you store it, or is there, is there a percentage loss from storage, and is there a percentage reduction from compressing to store and handling the gas? And what would that amount to?
Senator, through the chair, Senator Wagner, there certainly is a lot of arithmetic to be carried out. The good news is that most of the percentages we would be talking about in a negative sort of way are very small percentages. Okay. And very frankly, they might be a lot smaller than the annual inflation in the price and value of the gas you're storing. And so, if you will, your bank account would be appreciating faster than the vault is leaking. And it could work out that way. In any case, it seems to me that, again, the state may want to examine its role, because we generally look at ourselves as having a very low interest sort of mentality mode in terms of interest rates. The other thing is that by levelizing the throughput in the pipeline, you gain a tremendous advantage and savings in the tariff. And again, that arithmetic works to your favor. So you might be willing to accept the losses, you might be willing to accept the holding charges, the storage charges, the interest, you might say, because of just even what you save on the pipeline tariff. And again, that's part of what needs to be evaluated here. It needs to be understood as to who might do it, how you might do it, and everything else. But one of the biggest problems we've seen raised in terms of objection to projects at times is that they require a long ramp-up period. And this is to just simply say, not the case here. And it's to try and illustrate how you would, in the real world, deal with that issue. And you would just levelize it by using storage.
Second question, maybe you can talk a little more about gas liquids and what eventually the gas liquids impact would be on the state of Alaska versus allowing those liquids to go out of state, in state, out of state production and handling?
In a pipeline the size we're describing here, we would be looking at ethane numbers that clearly were measured in tens of thousands of barrels a day, propane numbers that would probably be in the range of 5,000 to 10,000 barrels a day of propane. When you look at the larger projects that might occur and the fact that you would run those propane and ethane down the small pipeline, those numbers start to approach 100,000 barrels a day of ethane and 50,000 barrels a day of propane. These are huge numbers. A petrochemical facility can be built on the basis of, say, 50,000 barrels a day of ethane. So we're talking about a volume that potentially is two major petrochemical facilities. Those are not necessarily going to happen. It may be interesting to see who shows up at this joint study also that wears a chemistry hat. And we might find out there are some interests there in the longer run. The good part of the NGLs is that it's a large resource on the North Slope. It has no place to go but into the gas pipeline. And because the molecules are so valuable in a recovery conservation sense, you have to place some emphasis on finding a market for them, getting to a market. They transport well in a pipeline. Once they're outside a pipeline, it gets a little trickier, especially with ethane. So you tend to build the plant that uses the ethane right at the end of the pipeline. You don't build it somewhere across the ocean and ship ethane to it. You build it there, and that's the way it works. There's there are reasons that people, both from an LNG point of view and in particular from a petrochemical point of view, would be interested in coming here and looking at this area seriously. And again, it has to do with where else in the world can they find supplies in similar quantity to the types of materials we're talking about here. The markets in the Middle East that people describe as the huge sources of methane, ethane, propane, and all that are fairly tightly controlled at this point. And many of the companies that are not involved there directly have limited opportunities to get in there. In some discussions, people mention places like Iran, Indonesia, and Sakhalin. And again, until a few months ago, Sakhalin was probably the top of the three. It's probably dropped to the bottom of the three now because of the actions of the Russians confiscating half of the Sakhalin interest. If you're faced with those choices, Alaska becomes a very attractive place, frankly. And you're going to work really hard to see if you can make something pencil out here because of all those inherent advantages and availabilities. And again, that's the reason for the optimism. And I know I'm being optimistic, but that's the reason for the optimism, is that I think we have something to offer that it's not easy for others in the world to find.
Thank you. We heard a lot of talk last year, competing lines, one going down to Valdez, all Alaska line, another going Alaska Highway route. Can you just briefly compare how this project, the Alaska Gas Market System, compares to what was referred to last year as the All Alaska Line in terms of cost, revenue to state, Alaska jobs? And secondly, if a larger All Alaska gas line is agreed to, what is our ability to upgrade this line to accommodate that? Is there any kind of interaction between the two?
Senator, through the chair, in the most simple sense, if you compare the way this project is laid out in a minimal sense to, for instance, what was commonly referred to as the All-Alaska Line, basically some derivative of the original Yukon Pacific LNG project out of Valdez, this project is smaller. If you chose to make the LNG portion of this bigger, for instance, let's say we go through this joint study process and enough people show up that want to spend money to build a plant twice as big as what's in this proposal. That starts to look like the All-Alaska project. Now, you'd have to put in a bigger piece of pipe to get there, but you size the pipe to the people who are willing to make the commitments at the other end of it. You don't size the pipe just because you want it to be bigger. You have to have people that have money and are willing to make the commitment to buy the bigger pipe. So in a way, this is maybe a downsized version. Certainly, at the size of a few billion cubic feet a day, you are talking about a project that has very major implications in terms of employment, revenues, other things to the state of Alaska. The project that's proposed here is much more modest. It would require, say, two crews for pipelining of maybe 500 each, so that's 1,000 people. It is the type of workforce that is readily available in Alaska. It would, you know, lead to multiple years, probably 3 years worth of good jobs for 1,000 people directly working on the pipeline itself. So that's a major, major impact. At some size of scale, it is our estimate that things start to get away from you, and it might be risky and difficult to project how that impact is fully on Alaska. I lived through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I was up here in Alaska, and I can tell you that when things start to get really big, all of a sudden things start to happen that you hadn't expected in the communities. This kind of an approach is much more manageable if the market pull is there. If the market pull is there and it's stronger, there's no reason this project couldn't be made bigger. But again, we have not designed it with that in mind at this point. This is a very workable, we think, strong market pull behind it.
In, I could just follow up, just in terms of interchangeability, if we go with this smaller line and then we want to go with a major export line, how interchangeable is this line? Or how easy is it to upgrade this line?
If you had installed this system and you wanted to bring a much larger reserve to market, you would build a separate line and go all the way to Chicago. And this line would continue to operate. It would still be a very good line. It would be very cost effective. It would be meeting Alaska's needs. And you'd ship all the NGLs down of it, and we could enjoy the benefits of a petrochemical industry. If a year from now we had invested some time and energy and money in understanding this, and you said, no, we're going to go with this big pipe down through Canada, I know how to put my hand on that drawing right at Delta Junction and cover up the part north of that. And all of a sudden, we've got a wonderful workable project that goes south from that point and ties off the big pipeline. Now, again, that may not be some people's first plan, but it is something we would have to seriously consider at that moment. And there, again, strong benefits for Alaska. Again, I perceive, I don't know, but I perceive that the governor's AGEA, the legislation, will place large weight on in-state gas use. And if that's the case, then I think, again, this is a worthy way of addressing that and making sure that we understand whether we should or should not be bringing that gas, say, for instance, in a spur line to South Central. What are the real issues in making that work? Mr. Chairman, I had promised you to spend a few minutes on the Port Authority memorandum.
Yes, we could do that, the MOU. But let me ask you one thing, Harold, sure. Very, very quick. You can give us a 10-second answer. How we define the gas stranded or not, does it have any impact on your course of action?
Mr. Chairman, there is nothing in this proposal that is legislatively dependent. This is a very business-like approach. I consider this a way, in a commercial sense, of looking at this transaction. Certainly, I have in my brain and heart some concerns about making sure Alaskans are taken care of. But it is done in a very business-like way. There is no benevolence in here. There's no gimmies. There's no nothing. Again, whether that proves to be the case, whether some help is needed at some point in the future, I can't tell you. I do know that other examples of organizations like ours, like the Wyoming Natural Gas Development Authority, has been very effective by providing, for instance, lines of credit and other types of credit guarantees, and doing things like that, aggregating supply, those kind of steps. And they've allowed a lot of good things to happen for the state of Wyoming by doing that. I would never preclude that we might not come to you and within ANGDA's bonding authority say to you, we would like to do this.
And you said Wyoming was effective. Is that what you said? Effective?
They were very effective. Okay. Yes. Yeah, they basically had one example where they provided a $300 million line of credit. They debottlenecked their pipeline systems. They got wells drilled, pipelines built. They woke up a few years later and the state of Wyoming was realizing $500 million more revenue every year.
Let's go to the MOU. Thank you.
Okay. Senator, in terms of the MOU, recently the boards of the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority, we generally commonly refer to them as the Port Authority, and the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, ANGDA, and it gets confusing because we have the same first and last name, and I always have to stop and think about what's in between. Our boards approved a memorandum of understanding between us, and I didn't really make a big deal out of all the words that are in there because I think it's only important that you understand the intent and the importance of it. The intent is in no way to restrict what each of us do. We maintain a high degree of independence. But it does provide for a degree of cooperation that was not possible before the memorandum of understanding. As two public agencies, one of our biggest problems is we can't keep a secret. And the memorandum of understanding basically acknowledges that there will be times when we need to talk to each other and we need to say, would you please keep this confidential? Mm-hmm. And it can be. The best example and one of the strongest motives I had for pursuing this was that I know that the Port Authority has good and valuable work that was done for them by Bechtel. Bechtel was not paid for that work. Bechtel owns that work that was done and has every right to a third-party confidentiality prohibitions and all those kind of things. Under this memorandum of understanding, I can sign a confidentiality agreement. I can take a look at it. I can use the work without revealing it. I can use the work. And frankly, I can save the public spending a public dime to do the same type of thing. It gets me another data point, in this case, based on something that already exists. So that's probably one of the bigger motives of this. The most important thing probably about this, frankly, is that both the Port Authority and ANGDA have shared since our very beginnings, in two different ways, by the people, we've shared sort of a mission, goals type of thing that is very much in common. This is important because two boards raised their hand and voted unanimously to do this, and they kind of shook hands in a very friendly, cooperative sort of way and said, we're going to work on this together, and wherever we've been in the past, we're going to try and work closer together and going into the future without giving up any of the autonomy, any of the independence of the two organizations, without any commitment other than to work together.
Questions for Mr. Hines? Harold, you envision your system as you described it, that you would be an applicant assuming some sort of competitive process. Is that kind of true?
Mr. Chairman, again, we don't know the details of what the governor will bring forward, but she has certainly described a process that involves the submission of a number of different proposals. Some sort of evaluation of them, and then some sort of process that goes to a next step, and you know, maybe the state at that moment goes to a short list, or maybe they decide, you know, we really like this one, or maybe they say, you know, if the three of you would really get together, this would be a far better world. And so on. I don't know. I don't know what that process is going to sound like in terms of the legislation, but all I can tell you is that ANGDA, in bringing this forward, does it in a constructive spirit, that we are prepared to be part of that process on a very level playing field with anybody else, but at the same time, we're very cognizant that there may be other people who bring forward better proposals, and that's the way it is. And that's good for Alaska if they do. You know, you kind of beat me fair and square. I, you know, more to you and better for Alaska.
Yeah. How does the state get its money out of this? Is it, you see it as in kind? Is it in value? How do you see this unfolding?
I think what we would propose to do is ask you, as part of whatever capital process takes place during the session, to look at funding us to the level of $5 million. Again, I'd be happy at some point to demonstrate our frugalness. We've managed to get a pretty long way with not a lot of money and have been pretty careful managers of it and pretty good scopers of studies and managers of the studies. That money, I don't know exactly where it will come from. I don't know exactly how it would work or fit into other things that people may have on their mind at the time. One of the conditions I've always looked people in the eye and said is that if there are any successful efforts of what ANGDA has worked on, it is our intention to retrieve through our contribution to whatever the entity is, the business, to retrieve the public money that was put into it. So I guess I'm asking for sort of a grubstake loan in this case on it. And, you know, I'm not, it is an appropriation and it's gone when it's gone, but it certainly is our intent in thinking about this money of how do we get it back into the public funds and how do we get value for what we spent in doing this? And everything we've constructed here, I think, goes down that pathway.
Okay. Other questions? I'll follow up with you then. My hearing's not very good, but what I think I heard you say, when it comes to the process of how we're ultimately going to get gas in this line, cooperation to build the gas pipeline, is that, this will be my terminology, that a producer breaks ranks and says, Harold, I want to help you, and we'll make money. Is that inaccurate, the way I described that, or is that accurate?
I think, for instance, I'll paint you a scenario. Let's say we get to a point where it's obvious that the big project requires going through Canada. And let's say that some courts of very major jurisdiction in Canada turn the whole cart upside down. They rule that everything that's been done is unconstitutional, and they say start over. Just as an example, at that moment, my experience in the corporate world is such that at that moment, each of the companies would have to check their whole card and see what they want to do, how they want to play the hand at that moment. And they have to each look at their own set of cards, not at each other's cards. It's, you look at your own card, because they have that responsibility to their shareholders, for sure. I can't tell you what they would decide at that moment, but some of them may see this as a good thing to do. Some of them may not. If there is the ability for some to move forward and bring their gas to market, then they may very well choose to do that. And it's my understanding that that type of decision is permissible under the laws of the United States, and that commercial self-interest is a good one. I'm not predicting that that will happen, but I can visualize circumstances where we are not in the sessions you were in a year ago.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Harold? Harold, if you would stay there. We have Lori Backus with AGPA.
AGPA,
excuse me.
Is she still on?
Okay. Lori, to the extent that the MOU has some effect on you, I would ask you not to give us a sales pitch of your course of action, if you would just talk to us about the MOU, since you're one of the signatories.
Actually, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Lori Backus with the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority. I would ask to be allowed to defer that question to Mr. Paul Foose or Mayor Bert Cottle, who is one of our board members who are there in person.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huggins, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Yes, and I help participate in this process. And just to make sure that, as Harold said, that they have similar goals and aspirations, that we're really working together at the closest level. There's no sense in duplicating efforts. There's no sense in, you know, one looking like they're ahead of the other one or trying to do it. One was formed by three of the municipalities of Alaska. The ANGDA was formed by a statewide vote of all the people. In every case, the vote was at least two-thirds of the people voted for it. So it is an expression of the will of the people. So we are responsible to the public just like you are. We have a responsibility to work together to do what they asked us to do.
Right. Okay. All right. Any comments on the MOU?
No, sir. If you wouldn't mind, I'd just like to comment on just a couple things real quick. Harold mentioned an open season. I think, you know, starting with a smaller project, something that gets something going, when you hold an open season and other people come in, then you have to make a decision. Both new explorers and also people who hold existing gas reserves on the North Slope, do they want to commercialize them then? And I think that's kind of, you want to say, that's how you call the hand. An open season is where you tell people, are you in or aren't you? But I think Senator McGuire is correct. You do need an initial gas supply, and you know, Point Thompson, we'll see how that turns out. But I think, as Harold mentioned, the royalty gas is there. Senator McGuire, you talked about them owning the gas, and, you know, they have leased the gas, but we do retain one-eighth of that, and there may be some technical issues on it, but if we said to the producers, we want our royalty gas because we want to bring that gas to our own people, and they said no, how would that make you feel?
Questions for Mr. Foose? Well, on behalf of the committee, sure. Yes.
I got another one.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And this kind of goes back to Nova and some of the other companies in Canada. And if we don't have a line going through Canada, if our gas liquids, would they be applicable to Alberta's large demand for pollutants? And could we sell them on a competitive basis and kind of export and import them from here to Prince Rupert and then over by pipeline? Do you see that in the future, possibility?
Senator, through the chair, thinking about what if logistics is always tricky, but if there was no line through Canada and they were still interested in, for instance, the propane, that might be very transportable to them through some mechanisms. Frankly, they would have to pay a price that was competitive with some other high-value markets, not the least of which are the Chinese and a few other folks in the world on the other side of the Pacific Rim. If what we're talking about was ethane, that would be much more difficult logistically, because again, that is a pipeline type thing that you move. But you know, I think the big point I would make there is that if you have a small project, if you have something where Alaska has control of how the NGLs flow, then I think you can, if you flow them down through Canada, make sure you get full value for. And I think that's a very important consideration. And the only way you know you got full value is to have both an alternative and to have control to move it between those alternatives. And at that moment, you will get the best price for that commodity.
Just kind of a follow-up for some of the people on the committee who haven't looked at gas liquids. It's estimated an 80,000 barrel plant on ethane, for instance, will employ between 600 and 900 people in that plant, both full-time employees and contract employees. And that's why I kind of keep keying in on this. That's a lot more jobs for Alaskans at a higher value per job than anything we can imagine as far as operation of a pipeline system. So that's just the key on that. And that's why it's important, if at all possible, to encourage people to do in-state processing of natural gas liquids here in Alaska.
And Senator, just if I may, to build on that, again, the point to remember always with petrochemicals is it's not only the sort of manufacturing industrial complex that is being described there, it's at the next level, because all that complex turns out is basically a feedstock for all the plastics industry, everything else there is. And there is a value in the next level of manufacturing that starts to take place with, if you could imagine, specialty products, for instance, designed for the Arctic or something like that. You can set up a whole string of activities that are very important in terms of our almost non-existent manufacturing status in this state, and yet the importance of developing it.
Mm-hmm. Senator McGuire.
Okay, just one final thing too, Harold. When you're looking at it, you know, considering those value-added opportunities, I think is a really good thing. And it made me think about Nutricity. Do you remember them? That company that came to town about 5 years ago. And they had such an interesting idea, which was that they needed a gas supply, but they were going to warehouse big data processing plants because there isn't a whole lot of land in the lower 48, and you need a big footprint, and you can employ quite a few people. And there's just some really neat innovative, it just is reminding me of all the innovations out there that we've kind of had to pass by without having a gas supply. But I don't know if it's something that you can consider. But
Senator, through the chair, if you remember back to the Nutricity, the trick was they wanted to be on the North Slope because it was cold.
Yeah.
Because you actually spend more energy cooling the electronics than you do running them.
Yes.
if I can put it that way. And so opening the door was a real advantage to cool it in their mind. So that was part of what they were looking at there in a sort of a very unique sort of way, a niche sort of way. There are very clearly, once you start to look downstream of some of these activities, there are very interesting things people come up with to do. And I wouldn't even start to try and invent all the things. But we do already in the state have very limited plastics manufacturing of an extremely high-value product, and extremely high value. And if we could encourage that kind of, again, entrepreneurship, it might be very interesting.
Last thing, just on that point, if I might, Mr. Chairman, was that I remember one of the barriers was to getting a rate set, and the proposal was very similar to what Paul was just saying, which was, okay, if we can't get a producer to sell us some of the gas from their leases, then we'll go ahead and use in-state royalty gas. And the problem was Knowles was governor at the time, and nobody wanted to set a rate for the gas. So it's just something to keep in mind. You may, I don't know if you'll bump up into that again, but.
Okay, one last question, Senator Stedman, and we'll be concluding.
Well, just on Senator Wagner's point, we spent some time on this last year, and along with the presentation with the petrochemical potential that the state has with a gas line and the challenges you spoke about last year on open season. How do you not get blocked out of it on dealing with open season when you have an industry that isn't in place? And how do you get through the open season, come back in over a few years? I take it you've solved that issue, or are we still struggling with that one?
Well, Senator, besides being a small market here in Alaska, it is an undeveloped market. Probably the best example I can give you is how are we going to deal with the situation of Fairbanks Natural Gas? Right now they use a relatively minor amount of gas in the form of basically trucked LNG. Obviously, once gas is coming through their community, that system will expand. I mean, I don't know the estimates, but maybe it will be 100 times bigger than it is today at some point. If that's the case, how do we reserve them that space out into the future? Okay, and again, that's one of the reasons we would like to see participants in this that are consumers as well as producers and pipeliners and everybody else, is that those kind of tables or those kind of things hit the table. The other part I will tell you is that we are working with the Alaska Power Association, which is most of the utilities, electric utilities in the state, to work with them on an educational process on the open season so that they can see what it takes and what kind of decisions they have to make in preparation for this. So we're trying to do the background work on it. Again, being able to participate in a process like this would probably make it much more real for them. Rather than just practice.
Well, with that, Merrill, I'd like to say thank you to us as a committee and the Alaskans. And my assumption, when we get the gas pipeline done and we have the picture of the ribbon cutting, your picture will be in the middle of that, your face. So we say thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. And Senator, Mr. Chairman, if there are any informational needs, we're very web available. We are responsive, as any good state agency is, to inquiries. All the information we have is available electronically, and we do that. You don't even have to have our website. Just Google ANGDA, A-N-G-D-A, and even if you get close on the spelling, you will get 1,000 hits. So it's that easy.
Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.